In his famous poem, Ozymandias, Percy Shelley wrote of a traveler who came upon two great legs of stone in the desert. Near them, he found a shattered face lying in the sand with a wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command. On the pedestal where the statue had once stood so proudly were engraved these words: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." The poem concludes, "Nothing else remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Shelley perfectly captured there the utter futility of man's godless conceit and confidence in his own powers. But how many people who are far from being kings live with this same attitude of independence in building their lives? How many of us are considering God's will and seeking His help in the conduct of our lives from day to day? Are we acknowledging God's sovereignty over our works? Or are we saying, "Look what I have done," and be amazed? Do we acknowledge God's sovereignty over our possessions, our health? How about over our goals as families? Or how we will use the time and resources that we have? James has been speaking in the preceding verses about friendship with the world, being enamored with its standards, its philosophies. He's traced this friendship to such behavior as fighting and quarreling, lusting and envying. And above all, he has linked that to selfish pride. And now we see another result of friendship with the world. We gain an unwarranted confidence in our own plans, our own abilities as we pursue the activities of life. So we're going to look at the potential for self-reliance that even a believer can fall into at times. We have first what we would call the habit of self-reliance in verse 13. "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit." This is somebody who obviously is in the habit of thinking in this way. James begins with some imaginary words of some Jewish tradesmen. And this indicates a presumptuous kind of a life. In this apparently typical situation of his day, James is wanting to point out that there is no sense of dependence upon God on the part of these people. Such a person speaks as if today and tomorrow are a given, completely within his power. Such a person assumes that the journey to this other place will be a safe one. He presumes that this year of business is at his disposal. He supposes that the venture is sure to be prosperous. He thinks, "I've done this before. This plan has worked before, as far as I can tell. I know how to go about this. I've got this taken care of. No problem. This is just how it's going to unfold. But to all such presumption, both among the Jews to whom James was writing and among those of us today who might tend to shut God out, there is a stern warning here. The words, "Come now, you who say," could be translated, "Woe unto you who say this," or "Who do you think you are to say this?" I almost made that my title for this message. Who do you think you are? But God would say to us in our self-sufficiency, "Hey, hold on a minute." He's bringing up short those who would claim to be self-made men. A doctrine that has fallen on hard times in the church recently is brought to the fore here, and that is the teaching of the providence of God. The providence of God. And this is our complete dependence on God to provide for us everything that we need, everything that would be good for us. We are perhaps more willing to confess our need of God at certain special times. We're going to have a child dedication, so we recognize that God needs to be brought into this situation. A marriage ceremony, a time of crisis, at a funeral, for instance. Folks seem to agree that, you know, with the pastor when he says that God in his wisdom has taken this individual whom he has created. It was his time. The Lord was involved in that. But what about the great span of time between our birth and our death? This is where we really show what we think about God's involvement in our affairs. With Job, yes, we ought to say, "Naked I came forth from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return." The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. But are we living each day with a consciousness that is the Lord who sustains, and that our next breath must come from Him? We can fall into the habit of figuring that, well, we can handle whatever a day brings. Yeah, we might need to turn to the Lord for some really big things, but just, hey, the day-to-day things that I do, why would I need to depend on the Lord for that? We know how to do our job. I know how to do this. I don't need to seek the Lord on this. I can, you know, run my errands. I know how to make that successful. I know how to spend my money. I don't need to consult, you know, the Lord on that kind of thing. I don't need to depend on the Lord in regard to how I use my free time. It's there to be used, and I just decide what I want to do. We know how to arrange a vacation trip. We know how to discipline our children. You know, we have our way of doing things, right? And it seems to work. We rely on our talents and intelligence to deal with whatever comes up. But we need to see how deeply self-reliance has become ingrained into our lives. Now, we could have a wrong reaction to this verse, I suppose. And I do want to talk about the other side. This is not telling us that we are never to do anything for ourselves or ever to make any kinds of plans. We do not neglect responsible forethought, even creativity. Some verses from Proverbs. Proverbs 21:5. "A plan in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding..." Oops, that's not it. 21, even though it did have plan in it. That's interesting. 21:5, not 25. "The plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty." The plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage. Diligent people do make plans. We're not speaking against planning here at all. 16:1. Proverbs 16:1. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Verse 3, commit your works to the Lord and your plans will be established. Verse 9, the mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. In all of that, it's taken as a given and a rightful thing that we will make plans. That's not a problem. The book given to us for wisdom for everyday life tells us that though God is sovereign, and ultimately his will is done, it is to our advantage to make plans. So let's not miss the point. God is saying, woe to those who leave him out of the plans. Make your plans, but make sure that God is included in the planning. Woe to those who don't wish to wait prayerfully upon his direction, seek his blessing on our plans. Woe to those who think that they have life all figured out, who just ignore God. So that's the habit that we can fall into. Now let's talk about the folly of self-reliance. Egotistical creatures that we are, we forget that we are not guaranteed success in our ventures or even continuing life. Verse 14, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Proverbs 27:1 tells us, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. We have constant reminders from experience about what tomorrow might bring. The stock market goes up, it goes down, it goes all around. Economic downturns have left many holding the bag. They presume certain things, you know, that were going to happen because of their clever moves. Many who bought homes when real estate was considered to be the ultimate investment. You've got to, you know, get yourself involved in real estate or you're just going to be left behind. And then years ago, they found themselves suddenly underwater financially and have yet to recover in many cases. Tremendous numbers of people have naively launched their boats into the matrimonial seas only to encounter shipwreck in sudden squalls because God was not in the planning or was left out once the ceremony was over. Sometimes God has given, you know, a tip of the captain's hat to sort of, you know, spiritualize what we were going to do anyway. And we think we can take it from there. I just heard of a couple who were, you know, already in counseling not long at all after their marriage. They had realized quickly after marriage that they had almost nothing in common. The pastor that they went to asked, well, how did this marriage come about? And they said it had resulted from a message on the fall of Jericho that they had heard at another church. The preacher had said, as an application of that narrative, that if a man wanted to claim a woman as his wife, he should march around her 7 times and the walls of her heart would fall down. This is a true story, okay? This is not the story is told or something. You know, this is a true story. Amazing. And the man had followed, hearing that message, had followed that procedure with a girl that he liked the look of, didn't really know anything about her, but decided, well, I'm going to take this as a word from the Lord, did this and asked her to marry him, and she said yes. That is fleshly presumption with barely a fig leaf to try to cover it up. That kind of decision-making will not survive the unexpected difficulties of life. That couple put themselves in control, not God, and paid the price. How many young people head out into the world of education and career with great expectations, only to see it all turn to dust because God's face was not sought in any of it? All of it was about just the, you know, kind of the clever, smart thing that everybody ought to do, and that this will lead to this, and so make sure you adhere to this plan. They assume that the result of the degree or whatever it is will be living in a certain place, working a certain job, receiving a certain salary. You know, it's all, you know, devised in their minds. They'll buy a house. They're going to live the American dream. Because don't they deserve it? Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? So, you know, who cares what else goes by the wayside? Just keep that dream central, because, gosh, even Christians, don't they all agree that you've got to buy your own house and you've got to have these certain things, these trappings of success? It's all done without truly considering what the Lord wants. It's done without considering the spiritual consequences of that pursuit. Then people get into a certain bind, a jam. They feel that they can't follow the Lord's leading in this or that direction because they've got these obligations now that they were sure they had to take on, because that's just what you do. But is that what the Lord wanted? Maybe the Lord wanted you to be more flexible, more ready to follow Him wherever He would want you to go. Maybe He didn't want you taking on all of those obligations. This doesn't mean that we become anxious about life, fearing that everything could be taken away at any moment. Jesus said not to be anxious about tomorrow. We can't add a minute to our lifespan with such an approach. And you're not going to add a dollar to what the Lord wants you to have by acting that way either. We can trust the Father to provide what is actually needed for us to accomplish His will. But is that what's important to us, accomplishing the Lord's will? Following the path that He's directing, giving Him the credit for everything that comes our way. Is that important to us? If it is, then we can be sure that if we ask God for a fish, He will not give us a snake. We walk that line between being fearful on the one side and being arrogant on the other. Fearful, oh, I don't know what I'll have if I just trust God. Or on the other, the arrogance of, look what I'm making of my life. The path of daily reliance on God is the pathway of peace in life. You see, we don't know if we have tomorrow. So to put too much stock in creating this wonderful material future on this earth is truly foolish. I remember a story my dad used to tell of a woman that he had known. She was a beautiful young lady, a good student at a private Christian college, clearly a very mature believer for her tender years. From the human view, she had a great future. What changed all of that in an instant? A mosquito bite. Got a mosquito bite. and it became infected. Okay. Still no big deal, nothing that would cause great alarm. But the medication that she was given for the infected mosquito bite caused an allergic reaction that killed her. I think of a man named Tom Puto, who was a deacon in my home church. He was hiking with some friends, nice camping outing, and he slipped on the side of the trail, fell off the side of the mountain, was killed. Nobody was expecting that when they set out for an enjoyable time walking through God's creation. Nobody anticipated that. But God has the final say. You'll do what you're going to do if the Lord wills. Many of you remember that my Uncle Harold visited with us here, attended a Wednesday night study with us, I think. Maybe when we were still up here. Had a great time with him, went apple picking, I think, it was that time of year, and just enjoyed the visit. And then he went on to visit with my brother's family in Des Moines, was killed by a man running through a stop sign who hadn't taken his medication that he was supposed to be on, and rammed right into his driver's side car door, and he was gone. Whatever further plans that Harold had, and he was a planner, well, they ended right then, okay? We are a vapor that appears for a while and then vanishes. We should hold our plans and our possessions loosely. I thank God that these that I have mentioned knew the Lord. They knew that they were not in control of their lives. But we need to make this more a part of our conscious thinking. We need to be humbled by our own fragility. We live at God's good pleasure, and we need to act like it. If God wants us to continue living on this earth, then we are indestructible. You know, that's the encouraging side of this. When times are tough, when persecution comes, when our lives might seem to be in danger, it's not if the Lord wants to keep us here. I mean, you know, you just have to think of Daniel and his friends. From the human perspective, they weren't sticking around. But the Lord had other ideas. They were not in any danger. We hear so many improbable stories, even in our day. There's the man who jumped off the top of the Empire State Building, only to be blown into an open window down below and survive with hardly any, you know, even a scratch. He decided not to continue his journey, so he went on to live a full life. There's the man who had to ditch his fighter plane over the Sierra Mountains in California after ejecting, he found that his parachute wouldn't open. Okay, well, at that point, thousands of miles up, not thousands of feet up, you know, you're making whatever peace with God, you know, you need to make. But he landed in a deep snowbank and survive. So let us see from such examples that God can sustain a life whenever he sees fit, no matter what it would seem is going to happen. And this all leads us to our last point, which is that we need to be God-reliant. God-reliant. We need to say regularly, whether out loud to ourselves, out loud or to ourselves, what James is suggesting in verse 15, Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. Job stated, in God's hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. Daniel said to the Babylonians, you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which you do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. How sad if we who do know God should not honor him in our plans. He is involved in all our ways. Paul said to the Athenians, in God we live and move and have our being. And that was not just talk for the ignorant. This reliance on God informed all of Paul's actions. Just a few verses to show how this was just part of his mindset, his perspective. Acts 18:21. But taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again if God wills, he set sail from Ephesus. I will return to you if God wills. Romans 1:10, we had this earlier in our study. Always in my prayers, making request, if perhaps now at last, by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you. I'll be able to come to you in Rome if it's God's will. 1 Corinthians 4:19. But I will come to you soon if the Lord wills, and I shall find out not the words of those who are arrogant, but their power. He understood all of his movements, where he ended up, how he got there, what condition he'd be in, what he would find, all of that. That was all up to the Lord. He didn't assume anything. And at times, Paul was prevented from doing what he himself personally wanted to do. But he knew that was of the Lord. Paul lived with this perspective that James is talking about. What we do in the next hour, this week, this coming month, throughout our lifetime, it depends on the will of God. This does not mean that we mechanically start saying, Lord willing, or some such phrase every time we speak of any kind of a plan. Okay? Anything can become a meaningless ritual. We do not try to one-up each other for how obviously we are putting God in the driver's seat. Okay? So we can just clear that right now. And we've talked as well about how words such as luck and fortune, how all such terms rob God of his place as the sovereign provider. So I won't belabor that. But let's just recognize this is a matter of our spirit, our constant attitude. And yes, to some degree, that will come out in the words we say, and we should be careful about the words we say and present truth with what we say. But this is a matter of the heart. Far more important than any words we would say is a heart that's continually acknowledging God's dominant role in all of our past experiences and all of our future plans. We don't boast about our accomplishments. We boast in the Lord. And I'm constantly being brought up short with this truth. And when, especially when I think I've pulled off and have pulled off some great eBay coup, you know, where, man, I did the research, you know, I did the homework, I spotted something, you know, I worked the plan, and I got that sweet baseball card at the lowest price anyone's ever got. You can go there, you can look at the 100 thing, you know, 100 examples of it being sold, and mine is the lowest one on there. I stole that card. I I took down eBay Nation. And yes, I did come up with a strategy, you know, and I worked it. But if you drill down into it, you realize that the Lord was behind every part of any success that you had. He gave you what you have, whatever intelligence or what, you know, ability that you have there. He was the one who led you to that particular card at this particular time. That could have become available at some other time where I never did look at it. If you're like me, you've come to the end of a day and realized, you know, God was not as much a part of my decision making, as much a part of my gratitude as he should have been. You know, most of us are not wickedly trying to oppose the will of God and keep him from having any praise and glory that is due to him for what he does for us. It's just more of a matter of not including him in our planning and depending upon him as we carry out those plans and then thanking him as they come to pass. But it's he that's going to prosper the work of our hands. It's not going to be out of our own control. It's coming because we're in control. But I've come to the end of the day and thought, you know what? I really presumed today. And yet, God does still graciously prosper us even when we're not doing very well as far as giving him the credit. And I think this is what James is getting at in verse 17. That can seem a little puzzling at first. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. This is a verse that we use generally as a reminder that there are sins of omission, okay? Sins of not doing what you ought to do. And I think it's right that we take that as a kind of a general truth. But often that is kind of produced and talked about out of the context of what's actually being presented here. We, yes, can't pat ourselves on the back for not committing any blatant sins on a given day, even if we were inclined to do that, because there are things that we knew God desired of us, you know, that we did not accomplish. But the tie-in here seems to be that if we know that God is to be honored as the sovereign provider of all things, and we do not give him his due, we do not recognize his sovereign control, his providence that we depend upon, we are in sin. We sin when we do not look to him as we should, as the one who is making every good thing take place. You know, it's no good to react to a rebuke from someone in this area with, yeah, oh yeah, well, yeah, that might have sounded like it was all about me, but I knew that it was really God that was behind that. I know that God brought that thing to pass that I was boasting about just now as if it was all about me. I know that. No, we need to start making that more clear by what we say, by how we talk about things. The Christian life is not one of self-sufficiency. It's a life of Christ's sufficiency. As Paul says, I am what I am by God's working in my life. May God forgive us, forgive me of past arrogance. And may we each seek what is important to God first, which is our heart dependence upon him, among other things. And then let him add all these things unto us as he sees fit. We can trust God to do whatever is best for us. Father, humble us once again. Allow us to see your hand in every aspect of our lives. Teach us to live in constant awareness of your providence. May a submission to your will be the backdrop of all of our planning. And may we be quick to give you the glory for all successes and for all setbacks as well. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.